Let's take our Bibles, if you would, please, and we'll go to the book of Exodus. We're in Exodus chapter 20 again, and going through the Ten Commandments. We're still in the midst of them. We're on the fourth commandment, actually, this morning. Four verses. Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 through 11. The Bible says in verse 8, as God's giving the Ten Commandments, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who's within your gates. For, because in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy." Entitled the message this morning, "Gaining Perspective." Just four verses, but as we've worked through the passage, we've just kind of given it an overview, we understand that everything is determined by our perspective. Perspective, how we look at things, determines the direction we go, determines our destiny. Our perspective, the way we see things, makes all the difference in the world. Perspective must then be governed by reality. Because I can see things wrongly by putting on simply the wrong pair of glasses. I can stand in front of a curved mirror in order to see things from a different perspective. For a long time, I've been fascinated with this idea of perspective and seeing things rightly. You remember that as I was working through my THM, I did a work on beauty. At that time, we tried to tie beauty in with reality. When we confuse the definition of beauty, we undermine our ability to find pleasure in that which is objectively good. How I look at these determines what I think of these. When I confuse the definition of beauty, I hinder my ability to know objective truth just based on my perspective. My perspective, if I don't have a true definition of beauty, limits my ability to experience objective reality. I see things for what they aren't, for real. Everything is governed by our perspective. Bill Gates was once asked, "Why is it that you don't believe in God?" Very pragmatic, in fact, a very hard pusher. Bill Gates used to go out into his parking lot and he would memorize the people's license plate numbers on the cars so that he knew who was at work that day and who wasn't at work that day. Bill Gates gave this answer. He said, "Just in terms of allocation of time resources, I don't have time for God. Religion isn't very efficient. There's a lot more that I could be doing on a Sunday morning than just sitting and talking or thinking about God." When we don't view God as worthy of carving our time out, guess what? We aren't going to give any other part of our life to Him either, which is still where Bill Gates is today. When we come to this Mount Sinai, God is bringing His people here for a perspective change. He's brought them here so that nothing else has their attention. They're out in the middle of a wilderness. This plane down here is easily able to accompany the roughly 2 million men, women, and children that had marched out of Egypt, marched through the Red Sea, had watched Pharaoh and his army drown. Now there's, other than the Amalekites, whom God had just taken care of in a battle that Joshua won while Moses held his arms up before the Lord, there's nobody to bother them out here. God's isolated them from everything else that's been around them. He's taken them out into the desert. It's quiet. It's bare. There's no water fountains. There's no fast food restaurants, but God is bringing them manna every morning. This is the place where Moses strikes the rock and water springs out from the rock. And it talks in Psalm 105 how God created a banquet in the wilderness. God's taking care of everything for his people at this moment. And the one thing God is trying to do for them is to give them perspective. We've spent a few weeks now talking about what God did to this mount, in shrouding it with smoke, in bringing up flames, in bringing forth the flashes of lightning and the soundings of the thunder and the trumpet, in bringing an earthquake that trembles the very mount and the ground on which they stand. And God says, you shall come up to the mountain, but you shall not touch the mountain. And God is seeking to impress on his people a very large view of none other than himself. God is all about shaping their perspective in this wilderness setting as he's preparing to bring them into the promised land. Because when they get into the promised land, they're going to be surrounded by the most dangerous things to their lives spiritually: blessing. And in the midst of all of their blessings, there's one thing that they might forget. No, there's one thing that they will forget: God. So God is trying to impress upon them a large view of himself, a view that they will not forget. He's trying to shape it and form it and forge it and press it into the very iron of their souls, who their God is. As we come to these Ten Commandments, God is revealing his will, a charter, if you will, with his people, a constitution of sorts. I am bringing you to my land, and God's going to remind them, this land, though it's your inheritance, belongs to me. I'm bringing you to my land, and these are my rules. This is the way we play the game in my land. And as we break down the Ten Commandments, we break them down in light of three realities. Three realities that are meant to govern the perspective of God's people. The first reality in the first three commandments are this: there's one God, and he's different from all others. The term is holiness. Thou shalt have no other gods other than me. And when you worship me, you don't make anything that's like me, because I am in fact not like anything. And in calling you to be my people and in giving myself to you to be your God, I want you to understand that I am placing my name upon you, and my name is holy. So you don't get to live like you jolly well please. You live as though you represent me, because in fact, you do. The last five of the commandments, beginning with honor your father and mother, and ending with not coveting your neighbor's wife, donkey, house, so on and so forth, are all governed by that perspective, that attribute of God's love. That's why in the New Testament, Jesus can say, the second is like unto it, namely this: thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love. What is my responsibility to my neighbor? To love him, to honor him, to not take something that belongs to him, especially his life, including his wife, not taking away his reputation by stealing from him and portraying him falsely to the community. Love. There's one right in the middle that holds these things together. That's the fourth commandment. Transitionary in part, because it speaks both of a responsibility to God and a responsibility to creation. Not just neighbor, it includes animals as well. But this perspective of reality that God is giving to his people, 10 laws, but there's something behind the laws. There's a holiness that God is trying to drive home to them. That holiness means it ought to result in a love for each other that looks like God's love for me. What does God's love for me look like? It looks like grace. And that's what this fourth commandment is all about. If our perspective isn't governed by a view of God's amazing grace, something else will govern that perspective. Something other than grace. Something like works, where I can only work my way to God, and that's in fact what I can't do, because God is holy, God is separate, God is other. God is righteous, and all have fallen short of the glory of God. There's none righteous, not even one. But God in his economy is setting up a people who are holy, who look like love, and live in light of God's amazing grace. What we see in this fourth commandment is that Sabbath rest reorients our depleted, earth-filled perspective. Anybody tired here this morning? You don't have to raise your hand. But if you're not tired, you're probably lying. Or you're probably not liked very well by everybody else who's sitting here. One of those two things. Because everybody else is tired this morning. What Sabbath does for us is it takes that perspective that's been drained. It's been sucked out. It's been dried out. It's been washed out. It's been laid out throughout the entirety of the week. And Sabbath rest allows us to saturate ourselves once again, to soak up, to have the very fabric of our souls reinvigorated, to have the life blown into us. Sabbath is, in fact, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation from God, very God, to the soul of man. Doesn't it feel like that in the midst of a Sunday morning? Oh, man, I got to hurry up, get there. And we're in the midst of observing Sabbath, and like the rest of the week, we're just, shrew, got that one done too. Can cross that off my list. We need to examine what Sabbath is for, because if we're not careful, even observing Sabbath looks like the rest of our week. And the whole point of Sabbath is to make the rest of our week look different, because the difference in this day. Well, we come to this passage. Eugene Peterson makes this comment: nothing less than a command has the power to intervene in the vicious, accelerating, self-perpetuating cycle of faithless and graceless busyness. God says, listen, I'm trying to build a perspective in your lives of who I am and how I operate. Our relationship, folks, is governed by holiness, grace, and love. These are 10 words, these are 10 laws, 10 rules that you must build into your lives to build up and weave into the fabric of your life a perspective that will enable you to be my people in the land that I've called you to live it out. And he's going to use that land as the beginning of his kingdom, through which all peoples on earth will one day be blessed. As we come to this, I think we need to ask very quickly, why a 7-day week? If you were to look up on the internet, you go to Wikipedia, you see that the names of our days are named after the 7, they call the classical planets. Planet simply means wanderer. The planets are the wandering stars in the sky. The 7 ones that you can see with the naked eye are the sun, the moon, then Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, and Saturn. In fact, our days, Sunday is named after the sun, Moon Day, and Saturn Day, you can kind of see there. Now, they're not in order from sun outward to Saturn. I don't know why they're in this way, starting with the sun, the moon, and working through them. They tried to ask this question back in the first century. Plutarch wrote a paper on it. His treatise has been lost, but others have referenced it. We don't know why it's in this order, but we know that others than the Hebrews observed a 7-day week. In fact, the French, during the French Revolution, tried to do everything off the decimal system. So they had this great idea. Let's not do a 7-day week. If the lunar calendar is roughly 30 days, let's break that down into triads of 10. Let's have a 10-day week, and we'll have 3 10-day weeks in a month. We'll have 12 months in the year. So he breaks it down into 10 days. In fact, they even have watches that were built with the 10 different days built into the watch. It didn't work very well. Because built into creation by none other than God himself, the creator, is the fact that man needs rest every seventh day, not 10th day. Aren't you thankful for that? Only 3 weekends a month. That'd get a little bit hectic. It didn't work well. Three designs in observing Sabbath. We're going to work through this quickly. I'm going to try to get through this in about 20 minutes so I can read an article. We're going to take a look a bit more at the theology of this afternoon. We're not going to cover everything just now, but that's not the purpose. The purpose is for us to understand and to drive home into our hearts why Sabbath is important and is important for God's people, including God's New Testament people. And what does that look like? There's three designs in Sabbath observation. The first is this: the Sabbath is designed for man's rest. You see it there. Verse 9. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work. Not you, not your son, not your daughter, not your male servant, not your female servant, not your livestock, not the sojourner who is within your gates. Sabbath, we talked about before, is from a verb in Genesis 2:2 that means to cease or to desist, to rest. It provides man a needed reminder of his limited ability. He uses the words there in verse 9, labor and work. Labor, we've talked about, has the idea of service. God says, Pharaoh, these are not your servants. These servants will serve me. They're my servants. They're to provide me, not labor as in building pyramids and monuments to my glory, but building a monument to my glory of grace to the peoples of the world is what he's calling them to do. You have a service to perform for God. It's an elevated service because it's an elevated master that you serve. And it's not just building monuments to his glory. It's becoming a trophy of his grace so that others can see what this God is like. When God calls me, he does so in the words of Jesus and says, learn of me, take my yoke upon you, for it is easy, it's light. My yoke is easy and my burden is light. This is a life infusing God. This is a life giving God. That's why Jesus can refer to himself as the good shepherd of the sheep. And he says, I have come that they might have life and have life abundantly. And as the servant of God, I labor in his servant, drawing from his grace and extending it to others. What a magnificent God. But God says, now you've got 6 days in which to labor. The other word that he uses is work. That is to conduct your occupation, your business. The idea behind the word work is to tend to your needs, the needs of your household, the needs of your plantation, the needs of your farm, the needs of your pantry. You've got 6 days in which you labor to do what needs to get done. You get it done in those 6 days. Day seven is different. It's a holy day. It's a day that word holy means set apart. It's carved out. It's separated from need-based living. He said there needs to be one day in the week where you're not governed by need. You're governed by rest. Well, what day don't you have need? God says you need to build into your life that I have given to you enough. It's not that Monday won't come around again and you're going to have to pick up whatever hat you wear to be about your business. You're going to have those 6 days in the next week. But one day out of every seven, you need to set it aside And it can't be governed by your need. It must be governed by the fact that God has given you what you need. That changes everything. Because once a week, you see how this full commandment starts out in verse 8? Remember. Remember. The idea there is not just get it stuck in your head, but the idea is play it out in your life. Practice this Sabbath day in keeping it holy. Because you need to come to that conclusion once every single week that what you have is, in fact, enough. That God isn't stingy in His giving. That God isn't recalcitrant in the gifts that He's extended to you. That God wants to, in fact, give you more. We looked at that this morning in Sunday school, how in Romans chapter 8, verse 32, God has given us the most that He could give us, His only begotten Son. And the question is posed by the apostle, why wouldn't He freely give you all things? He's already given you His best that He can give. This God loves to give. And one time out of every 7 days, I need to sit back and just thank God for what He's given me. To think about how He's met my needs throughout this past week. But you know what? I can't remember that when I'm in the midst of laboring, toiling, working to meet my own needs. He says, I've designed this on purpose for your rest. The idea that He uses in this context up in verse 11, the Lord rested on the seventh day, has the idea of relaxing, of quieting down, of unwinding, of kicking your shoes off, of letting your hair down, of putting the t-shirt on, taking the tie off. That's the idea. For 6 days during the week, you throw on the coveralls, you throw on the suit and tie, you get all gussied up to do the work that you have to do. But one day in the week, there needs to be some breathing room. And God says, I want you to have it. I've designed you to need it. Because man is made for more than just labor. There's a dignity in this command. Man's service to God goes beyond his activity for God. It's in this command that we find that God's primary concern for man is in man's being, not primarily in man's doing. And we see that what we do always flows out of what we are. And if my very soul is being sucked up and dried up and used up, guess what? What I do won't have any life to it for very long, because the very life of me is being sucked out. And God gives us this command for our dignity and reminds us that my service goes beyond my activity, that God is focused on what I am even more than on what I do. Now, He's concerned with what I do. I mean, these are Ten Commandments after all. But the only way I can do the Ten Commandments, and He says, New Testament, all of us are going to fall short. These are meant to acquaint you with your frailty, your weakness, your need of Jesus who fulfills these commandments. But the only way I can live in light of God's laws, Old Testament, New Testament, is when I'm living and soaking and saturating in light of God's grace. And that's the whole point. The Sabbath is designed for men to rest. The Sabbath is also designed for man to worship. You see what it says there. Verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor, do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. It's holy and it's meant for God. There needs to be one day out of every seven that I'm not living to meet my needs. I'm not living with the perspective of me and my responsibilities totally in my perspective. I'm living in light of God. I'm doing this in light of the fact that He has made this day holy. I don't make it holy. Verse 11, For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that's in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath, and God made this day holy. God set this day apart. God wants it to be different. All I can do is, verse 8, all I can do is keep it holy. All I can do is guard the holiness, the sacredness, the set-apartedness of this day. To set it apart, to practice holiness, then, is to exercise faith. Not doing for God, but trusting what God wants to do and has done for me. This changes everything. The whole point, the whole purpose of this is so that I can have time to set apart in my week to focus on the goodness and the graciousness of my God. When I do that, it's exactly what happens in Psalm chapter 46. Let's go there for just a second. You're familiar with it. I love the imagery of this poem because I find myself feeling like this so often. Verse 1, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in the midst of trouble. The idea of trouble is being pressed in from both sides. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth gives way, though the mountains, which are immovable, are being moved into the heart of the sea with its waters roaring and foaming, the mountains trembling at its swelling. This chaos is swallowing everything that's stable in my life. Have you had a week like that recently? Where chaos swipes you upside the head? It's like, whoa, everything that I was planning on is moving at this point. Verse 4. Now, there's not a sea, there's a river. There's a channeled source of life, not death, whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when the morning dawns. You move down to verse 10. Now listen, be still and know that I am God. Go back to Exodus. This is the whole point of the Sabbath commandment. God says, I've built into my creation your need for rest, and I've built into my creation an economy where 6 days of labor will yield 7 days of increase. And I've built it into my economy such that you must stop and be regenerated and be rejuvenated and be reinvigorated by the fact that I can do something for you that you can never do for yourself. I can give you life. Wow. Only God can do that. And once a week, stopping and putting God in front of our eyes and gazing on his goodness and his glory enables me then to become fit for the labor that I've been called to do for the rest of the week. It fits me for the service that I get to do for God, of showcasing his grace, his goodness to me, and showcasing his goodness to others. In fact, the third point here is the Sabbath is designed for man for evangelism. We won't go there just for lack of time, but up in chapter 31, God says, my people, this is what will especially mark you out. This is a covenant sign between you and me. You must observe Sabbath. It's in observing Sabbath that others will see what it means to trust me. It's in observing Sabbath that they will get to see me and not you. When you stop and see me, when you stop and worship me, when you stop and look at me, when you stop and fall again in love with me, do you ever feel yourself like the church at Ephesus? When Revelation chapter 2 says, I have one thing against you. You're busy, busy, busy. You're right, right, right. You're good, good, good. But you've lost your first love. Repent. Get back to your love. What is it that nourishes that love for God? You've had it before. You've lost it in the midst of the doing of life. It's getting God in front of my face again. It's allowing him to be thou my vision, O Lord of my heart. Not be all else to me, save that thou art. And when God becomes big in my vision, only then can I extend a proper vision of my God to others. A vision that enables others to see God's grand design. Look at how he states it there in verse 11. In 6 days the Lord made heaven, he made earth, he made the sea, he made everything that's in them. He built all of these things into creation, the realms and the occupants of it. But he also built into it work, and he also built into it rest. Because in 6 days, God did work, and on the seventh day, God did rest. This is the kind of God that he is. He did it by example. And keeping the Sabbath actually begins before the Sabbath. It means working well for 6 days, working hard for 6 days, giving it my best for 6 days, and then resting. And then working hard for 6 days, and then resting. And resting well. Working hard, resting well. Both are components that God's built into this equation. Not in a 10-day week, in a 7-day week. Not just a week that he exemplified, but a week that he commanded. A week that he structured into creation. And it says that he blessed this day. He made this day holy. It's different. It, in fact, is meant to be the source of God graciously replenishing his creation. The Sabbath then proclaims God's grand design, and it proclaims his gracious design. God has a desire to bless his creation, not curse it. God stands over each one of us as judge. He will give us justice for the works. He will judge us according to our deeds. But God's desire in judging his creation is not to bring us condemnation. God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. That the world through him might know life. God says in Ezekiel, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. That's not what I desire. It's not what I delight in. My delight is giving, is building, is blowing into, is rejuvenating, is filling you up with my life so that others can see my fullness in you. That's what I long to do. I desire to do. We so often view God as a chintzy, stingy God who wants to withhold blessings from us. Nothing could be further from the truth. But so often we avoid that which he gives as a means of blessing. One of the chief being one day governed by rest. Now, where does this fit? It's the seventh day in the Old Testament. It comes at the end of the week. We don't hear about Sabbath when it comes to New Testament. We really don't until Romans chapter 14, verses 5 and 6. It's mentioned. In Colossians chapter 2, it's mentioned, and there it says, now some of you observe a certain day, and others don't. If they observe this certain day, then let them observe it to God. If another doesn't observe a certain day, then don't give them a hard time. Jesus fulfilled all of the law, and he fulfilled all of it for me. In the old economy, rest comes at the end. But in the new economy, the rest comes at the beginning. Jesus Christ rises from the dead on the first day of the week. It used to be that I do my work, do my work, do my work, do my work. Oh, at the end, finally, it's done. There's rest. Jesus fulfills everything for me. He accomplishes for me what I could not accomplish for myself. Now, on the first day of the week, Jesus rises from the dead. Guess what day the early church commemorates and grabs onto and holds onto as that day of special remembrance? It's the first day. And we see it, it's mentioned in all of the Gospels a couple different times in the book of John. It's mentioned in the book of Acts. It's mentioned in the book of 1 Corinthians. This first day worship is the normal day of remembering for God's people. And it's from this day that they derive the energy to live out the rest of their days through the week. And so it takes this rest, this covenantal blessing, and it fronts it in Jesus Christ. That's why the Sabbath command is never repeated in the New Testament, because Jesus is our rest. Now, Jesus becomes the one through whom we do the rest of the works throughout the week. But the place of rest, remembering, in the old economy, comes at the end. Whether it's dispensation of innocence, conscience, human government, promise, law, grace, kingdom, God's work on earth is awaiting a rest. That's why Hebrews chapter 3 and chapter 4 says there's still a rest that's waiting out there for all of God's people. It's begun, but it's not fully in place yet. It still comes at the end. But once this rest comes, everything from then on is rest. It's a perfect rest in the presence of God, and it lasts forever. So why isn't Saturday, the Sabbath day, the Christian Sabbath? Because God doesn't mean for it to be anymore. We find our rest in Jesus. Sabbath rest, though, is meant to reorient our depleted, earth-filled perspectives that get sucked dry. For us, we worship on Sunday. It's our Sabbath. It's our rest day. It's carved out. We don't work on this day to meet our own needs. We work hard to get God in front of our perspectives, a perspective that must be governed by reality, the reality of God's grace. Now, I've told you that this is a command that I struggle with. I came to an article this week that I don't do this often, but I'm going to read to you, just like you're sitting in my living room. I'm going to read an article because I needed this article for myself. And he says it better than I can say it. So please humor me for just a little bit. I think this is something that all of us need to hear. This is called the Pastor's Sabbath. But you listen from whatever vocation God's called you to be in. Do you take a day off? Answer: unthinkable. In a world where a cobalt bomb might detonate any moment, how can the very people entrusted with the word of life to this doomsday population, how can we take a day off? This interchange took place in a seminary classroom while I was a student. The answer came from a prominent pastor whom I thought I had every reason to admire and therefore emulate. Thus, when I became a pastor, I practiced what had been impressed upon me: long hours, 7-day weeks, year after year. Most of my friends and mentors did the same. The only alternative I could imagine was slothfulness, by far the deadliest of the ministerial sins. After a few years, pressure from my wife and children got me to take an occasional break. I began to realize I worked far better and got more done in 6 days if I had a change of pace on the seventh. Remarkable. The arguments and evidence mounted. I was persuaded to take a regular day off. Then I noticed somehow, why it took so long I'll never know, my practice was not at all the same as the biblical practice of Sabbath keeping. I had more or less assumed I was being biblical, but actually, I stood in stark and utter contrast. My day off was basically utilitarian. It was for my needs. I had, in fact, a secularized Sabbath, making it possible to get more done on the other 6 days. It was also a common sense contribution to family harmony and emotional health. It was at that point that I set out to keep a genuine Sabbath. No other behavioral change has brought so many unintended but welcome benefits to my life of faith and my work as a pastor. Sabbath means to quit, to stop, to take a break. The word itself has nothing devout or holy in it. It's a word about time, denoting our non-use thereof, what we would usually call wasting time. The biblical context is the Genesis week of creation. Sabbath is the seventh and the final day in which God rested, Shabbat, from all his work which he had done. As we re-enter that sequence of days when God spoke energy and matter into existence, we repeatedly come to the refrain There was evening, there was morning, one day. There was evening and morning, a second day. There was evening and there was morning, a third day. And so on, six times. This is the Hebrew way of understanding day. It's not ours. Our day begins with an alarm clock, ripping the pre-dawn darkness, and closes not with evening, but several hours past that when we turn off the electric lights. In our conventional references to day, we do not include the night, except for the 2 or 3 hours that we steal from either end, and gives us more time to work. Because our definition of day is so different, we have to make an imaginative effort to understand the Hebrew phrase evening and morning one day. More than idiomatic speech is involved here. There's a sense of rhythm. Day is the basic unit of God's creative work. Evening is the beginning of that day. It's the onset of God's speaking light, stars, earth, vegetation, animals, man, woman, into being. It's also the time when we quit our activity and go to sleep. When it's evening, I lay me down to sleep and pray the Lord my soul to keep, and I drift off into semi-consciousness for the next 6, 8, 10 hours, a state in which I'm absolutely non-productive and have no cash value. Then, I wake up rested. I jump out of bed, grab a cup of coffee, rush out the door to get things started. And the first thing I discover, a great blow to my ego, is that everything was started hours ago. All the important things have gotten underway while I was fast asleep. When I dash into the workday, I walk into an operation that's half over already. I enter into work in which the basic plan's already established, the assignment's already given, the operation's already in motion. Sometimes, still in a stupor, I blunder into the middle of something that's nearly done and go to work thinking that I'm starting it. And when I do, I interfere with what's already been accomplished. My sincere intentions and cheerful whistle while I work make it no less a blunder and an aggravation. The sensible thing is to ask, where do I fit? Where do you need an extra hand? What still needs to be done? This Hebrew evening-morning sequence conditions us to the rhythms of grace. We go to sleep. God begins to work. As we sleep, he develops covenant. We wake and are called out to participate in God's creative action. We respond in faith, in work, but always grace is previous and primary. We wake into a world that we didn't make, into a salvation that we didn't earn. Evening, God begins without our help, his creative day. Morning, God calls us to enjoy and share and develop the work that he initiated. Creation and covenant are sheer grace, and they're there to greet us every morning. George MacDonald once wrote that sleep is God's contrivance for giving us the help that he cannot get into us when we're still awake. We read and reread the opening pages of Genesis along with certain sequences of Psalms and recover these deep, elemental rhythms, internalizing the reality in which the strong initial pulse is God's creating saving word, God's providential sustaining presence. In a word, God's grace. As this biblical rhythm works in me, I also discover something else. When I quit my day's work, nothing essential stops. I prepare for sleep, not with a feeling of exhausted frustration because there's so much yet undone and unfinished, but with expectancy. The day's about to begin. God's Genesis words are about to be spoken again. During the hours of my sleep, how will he prepare to use my obedience, my service, my speech when the morning breaks? I go to sleep to get out of the way for just a little while. I get into the rhythm of salvation. And while we sleep, great and marvelous things far beyond our capacities to invent or engineer are in process. The moon marks the seasons. The lion roars for its prey. The earthworm aerates the earth. The stars turn in their courses. The proteins repair our muscles. Our dreaming brains restore a deeper sanity beneath the gossip and scheming of our waking hours. Our work settles into the context of God's work. And human effort is honored and respected, not as a thing in itself, but by its integration into the rhythms of God's grace and God's blessing. Sabbath keeping also presumes the daily rhythm. Evening, morning, we can hardly avoid stopping our work each night as fatigue and sleep overtakes us, but the weekly rhythm demands deliberate action. Otherwise, we can go on working on the seventh day, especially if things are gaining momentum. But Sabbath keeping often feels like an interruption, an interference with our routines. It challenges assumptions that we gradually build up, that our daily work is indispensable in making our world go round. But then we find the Sabbath is not an interruption, but a stronger rhythmic measure that confirms and extends the basic beat. Every seventh day, a deeper note is struck, an enormous gong whose deep sounds reverberate under and over and around the daily percussions, evening, morning, evening, morning. Creation honored and contemplated, redemption remembered and shared. In the two passages where the Sabbath commandment appears, the commands are identical, but the supporting argument differs. Exodus says we're to keep a Sabbath because God kept it. God did his work in 6 days, then rested. If God sets apart one day to rest, we can too. There are some things that can only be accomplished even by God in a state of rest. The rest-work rhythm is built into the very structure of God's interpenetration of reality. The precedent to quit doing and simply be is divine. Sabbath keeping is commanded so that we internalize the reality that doing matures out of a state of being. The reason given in Deuteronomy for remembering the Sabbath is that our ancestors in Egypt went forth 400 years without vacation, never a day off. Consequence? They were no longer considered persons, but slaves. They were work units, not persons created in the image of God, but equipment for making bricks and building pyramids. Lest any of us do that to our neighbor or husband or wife or child or employee, we are commanded to keep a Sabbath. But the moment we begin to see others in terms of what they can do rather than who they are, humanity is defaced and community is violated. Perhaps that's why the Sabbath is commanded, not suggested. For nothing less than a command has the power to intervene in the vicious, accelerating, self-perpetuating cycle of faithless and graceless busyness. Sabbath. Uncluttered time and space to distance ourselves from the frenzy of our own activities so we can see what God has been doing and is doing. So the question is, so what can I do on the Sabbath? It's the wrong question. What can I do to get a greater perspective of my God? That's the question I need to be asking. So he says, our secularized age is so fragmented that no consensus in the details of Sabbath keeping is possible. We cannot prescribe a practice for each other. But lest the command dissolve into a fog of good intentions, I'll risk autobiography. The risk is that someone will try to imitate the details of my practice, or likely they'll say, boy, that's sure dumb. I don't see the point of doing that, and dismiss the whole business on the basis of inept practice. He says, bear with me. Here's how I keep Sabbath. Monday is my Sabbath. Nothing is scheduled for Mondays. If there are emergencies, I respond, but there are surprisingly few. My wife joins me in observing the day. We make a lunch. We put it in a day pack and take our binoculars and drive away anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour to a trail along a river or into the mountains. Before we begin our hike, my wife reads a psalm and prays. After that prayer, there's no more talking. We enter into a silence that continues for the next 2 or 3 hours until we stop for lunch. We walk leisurely, emptying ourselves, opening ourselves to what is there. Fern shapes, flower, fragrance, bird song, granite outcroppings, oak sycamores, rain, sleet, snow, wind. We have clothes for all weather, so we never cancel our Sabbath keeping for reasons of weather any more than we would our Sunday church going. And for the same reason, we need our Sabbath just as much as our parishioners need them. When the sun or our stomachs tells us it's lunchtime, we break the silence with a prayer of blessing for the sandwiches and fruit, the river and the forest, and now we're free to talk, sharing bird sightings, thoughts, observations, ideas, however much or little we're inclined. We return home in the middle or late afternoon. We putter around, do odd jobs. We read. After supper, I usually write family letters. And that's it. No Sinai thunder. No Damascus Road illuminations. No Patmos visions. A day just set apart for solitude and silence. Not doing. Being there. The sanctification of time. We don't have any rules for preserving the sanctity of the day, only the commitment that it be set apart for being, not using. not a day to get anything done, but a day to watch and be responsive to what God has done. But we do have help. Sabbath keeping cannot be carried out as a private enterprise. We need our congregation's help. They need our help to keep their Sabbath, and we need their help to keep ours. From time to time, I say something like this to my elders and deacons. The great reality we're involved in is God. Most of the people around us don't know that and could care less. But one of the ways God has provided for us to stay aware of and responsive to Him in a world that doesn't care is by Sabbath keeping. At regular intervals, we all need to quit our work and contemplate God's work, to quit talking to each other and listen to Him. God knows we need this, and He's given us a means in Sabbath, a day for praying and playing and simply enjoying what is and what He is. One of my tasks is to lead you in the celebration of Sabbath each Sunday, but that's not a Sabbath for me. I wake up on Sunday morning with the adrenaline flowing. It's a work day for me. Monday's my Sabbath. I need your help to observe it. I need your prayers. I need your cooperation in not involving me in administration or consultation. I need your admonitions if you see me carelessly letting other things interfere with it. Pastors need pastors too. One of the ways that you can be my pastor is to help me keep a weekly Sabbath, one commanded by God. And they do it. They help. I don't think there are many congregations who would not help us if they knew we were committed to it and needed their help in carrying it out. My wife has been keeping, off and on, a Sabbath journal for many of the years we've been doing this. The journal is labeled Emmaus Walks. You wouldn't be greatly impressed, I think, if you read the sporadic entries. Bird lists, wildflowers, snatches of conversation, brief notes on the weather. But the spareness records a fullness of presence, for Sabbath keeping is not primarily something we do, but something we don't do. They call it Emmaus Walks for this reason. Two disciples walking and talking together on the road to Emmaus, along with Jesus, unrecognized, but with them. Afterward, they knew. Did not our heart burn within us while He talked with us by the way, and while He opened to us the Scripture? It's a kind of unobtrusive alteration of perception that happens quietly but cumulatively in the practice of keeping Sabbath.